Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, delivering programs from radio's golden era. Mark Lavonier, your host for an hour of horror. Later on, it's The Haunting Hour from 1945. But first, The Hall of Fantasy, with an episode called The Mark of Shame, a CBS broadcast from May 1st, 1947.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Granite Furniture Company, with stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo, presents...
The Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the series of radio dramas dedicated to the supernatural, the unusual, and the unknown. Come with me, my friends. We shall descend to the world of the unknown and forbidden, down to the depths where the veil of time is lifted and the supernatural reigns as king. Come with me and listen to the tale of The Mark of Shame.
The Granite Furniture Company brings you the Hall of Fantasy. Listen now to original tales of the imagination and some of the classics of the supernatural as we take you down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy to the mysterious realms of the unknown. These are stories of eerie and fantastic thrills brought to you by your friends at the Granite Furniture Stores. And now for tonight's story, an adaptation by Robert Olson entitled The Mark of Shame.
Cousin Andre did more than run the natural errands of existence. That blood fed his hates, his prides, his willful ego, till the end of time and beyond. Yes, and that same blood flushed a vivid red mark of shame in Andre's fair young face. It was phenomenal, nothing like I'd ever seen before, nothing certainly like the welts on a child's tender back. This mark never faded from his handsome, womanish cheek. As usual, it had started over a woman. This happened at a masquerade ball given in the Palais Royal. A logical setting for quarrels over women, or privileges, or just quarrels. It was a gay affair. The women who followed in the footsteps of Philip of Orléans were likely grounds for controversy. One could hardly refer to their love as steadfast, but their favors swung from one brightly caped courtier to the other, from a fallen sword to a victorious one, with the swiftness of death itself. But such were our times. And in this colorful gathering, it was not difficult to recognize the predominant shade as a blood red. No need to mention the woman's name. It makes no difference anyway. She was not the issue. The issue was that André de Brissac, darling of the court, had been shamed, and I had dealt the smarting blow. I remember that moment with amazing detail. It was as if everything in that ballroom had suddenly been caught in startling paralysis of time, poised between one tick of the clock and another, one heartbeat and the next. Even the note of the music hung suspended, undecided whether to fly out the rich windows or fall and splinter like a Christmas ornament. I remember the dancers caught midway in a step, their faces turned toward me, the frozen gasp of the woman in question, sound that seemed barely to clear her lips, and paused in the awful highlight of that instant. And in Andre's eyes, poised the sharp, tempered steel of hatred and humiliation. Then, as if some unseen conductor waved the baton, the room was once more animated. The clock completed its tick, the heart its beat, and the note its soaring flight. The hatred of André de Brissac, flushed from the eye to the heart to the brain, thence to the voice that made it live in my memory forever. But the most amazing phenomena occurred a moment later, while he still stared at me. For to André, there came a crimson blush of shame, clearly outlined by the very form of my hand, in the exact spot where it had landed a flashing, stinging slap. So it was that on that dim August dawn, André and I crossed to one of the bridges that led to the ground beyond the church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, to fight a duel over a beautiful viper of the court of Philip of Orléans. André stood there opposite me with his two young friends at his side. They were all scoundrels, including my cousin, sorry to say. They seemed eager for this sport, We must have made a strange sight in that golden sunrise hour. We had just come from the Regent Saloon, still in the costumes we'd worn the night before. I was adorned, if adorn is the proper word for it, as a Mississippi Indian, while Andre wore a unique hunting habit, copied from a portrait that hung in the library of Puy Verdun, the family chateau. The orange and purple of his adornment looked pale in this early light. The mark on his face was all the more vivid.
I am ready, cousin.
Andre, when this is over, no matter what happens, will you promise me one thing?
Please. When this is over, one of us will be standing, the other dead. That's the only promise I care to make now.
That's true, Andre. But you force me into a situation for which I have no appetite. I'm a soldier, Andre. It is my business to cut down my enemy. Now, I'm the better swordsman. That's why we must talk now or not at all.
Then if you don't mind, cousin, we'll make it not at all. As for your being a better swordsman, you'll do me the honor of proving your skill.
Your curly locks have sabotaged your good judgment, sir. The captivating ladies of the court shall miss their nimble-tongued darling.
Ah, but they shan't miss his boorish cousin. Enough of this. On guard!
On guard, cousin! You stand well, my merry fellow of fortune. But I could teach you much.
Conserve your breath, cousin!
Ah, your beautiful face, Andre. Your parry was poor. My sword is tipped with crimson. Your lovely parabere would swoon to see that. It goes ill for you, I fear.
You glowed over a scratch.
Andre was really quite skillful, but not skillful enough. My contention that the court's fencing master could never compare to the art of learn or die brutality of battle proved correct. I mortally wounded Andre, and instantly I was mortally sorry. Life had been sweet for him as he lay there on the ground, the golden morning sun giving his beautiful features a pitiful glow. I thought I saw a look of despair come into his eyes. He realized that his lifeblood was ebbing away, like a tide that would never return. He beckoned to me, and I walked over to him and knelt at his side. Andre, forgive me.
Listen to me, Hector de Brazac. This is not the end of us. I am not done with the earth. Just because my jaw will soon stiffen and my eyes glaze over, they will bury me in the old vault of Puy Verdun. But that is not the end either. You will be the master of the chateau. They may even laugh to think that Andre has been killed in a duel. They will sing masses to my soul, and I will be done with them all. You have accomplished that, Hector, but you and I have not finished our business. I will be with you when you least know me. Andre de Brazac, with an ugly scar on a face that women have praised as love. I'll come back when your life is its merriest. At your happiest moment, I will come between you and all that you hold dear. And when this hand is a ghostly thing, dear cousin, I shall drop a poisoned potion into your cup of happiness. I shall stand between you and the sun for the rest of your life. Doubt not my will, Hector de Brazac. I can do as I please. And it pleases me to haunt you when I am dead.
I did not doubt the iron will of Andre. As he lay his head back on the dewy earth, never to lift it again, the chill breath of early morning touched me with inexpressible loneliness. I looked at him as he lay in his fresh one world of sleep. How fragile he seemed, built only for lace cuffs and bright buckles. I could see why he had been such a favorite. I could almost, even now, catch the fiery twinkle of those clear eyes. And no one who knew the short manhood of my cousin could deny the great force of his tempestuous nature. No, I looked down upon that young face which I had marked so foully, and was sorry for what I had done, truly sorry. As for the curse, I took no heed of the blasphemous threats. I was a soldier. I had seen many men die for my own sword. Andre had done me a cruel wrong. I couldn't have forgiven it. Men had died cursing me before, men who had loved life as rapturously as Andre. One more curse was, well, one more curse. I put it out of my mind. A very foolish thing to do. Andre's death had made me rich. But I found no pleasure in the wealth. This chateau, which had rung so with the raucous laughter of Andre's friend, became quiet and lonely. None of the servants showed me the slightest sign of friendliness. Even in the village, the children would shrink from me as I rode through. That's why I was so happy when the servant announced that Monsieur le Directeur was waiting to see me. Dr. Corday, I'm delighted, monsieur.
Oh, thank you, my lord. I have some medical reports on the patients in the village. I thought you might want to look them over.
I know nothing about such things, Corday. If there's no ravaging epidemic, I should be happy to dispense with it altogether.
Oh, there's nothing to fear. The usual aches and our share of deaths and our share of babies.
Good, doctor. Will you join me?
Well, I...
Do, monsieur.
Thank you.
Dr. Corday, what do the people in the village say about me?
Say? Why, the people love you, my lord.
You can dispense with them, my lord, Corday. I'm a soldier, not a court dandy. What do the people really say?
Shall I tell you?
Of course you should tell me. Why do you suppose I asked you? Oh, monsieur, forgive me. This is a bitter life. I have no taste for it. I'd rather be a soldier. I really would.
Well, in that case, you'd be quite interested in hearing what the people of the village say.
What is that?
That you have sold your soul to the evil one for your cousin's heritage.
That's really funny, Doctor. Really very funny. I never wanted this life, never once. I wouldn't hesitate a moment to trade it for a place in His Majesty's troops.
What you need is a wife, my lord.
A wife? I can't even win the sympathetic ear of a friend, let alone the heart of a lady.
It's a very gay season in Paris right now, my lord. You should find an angel there to take compassion on you.
Paris? A marvelous idea. At least I can be my own man there. Doctor, I'm grateful for your visit. Come in again when I return.
With a wife?
Who knows? In Paris, I ran into an old comrade, a sulky, sour old captain of dragoons. Many times he'd aired his displeasures to me. He told me a great many things about himself. But one thing he should have talked about, he never even mentioned. That was that he had a perfect sunbeam for a daughter. That her name was... Can you hear the music as I say it? Eveline. Eveline Lecalais. Eveline, I've been a fool.
Is it wise to tell me, monsieur?
Wise or not, I must. Eveline, I've been a soldier all my life. I know little about what pleases a lady. When I take your hand, I'm filled with the fear that you will not feel as I do, that there's someone else.
There is no one, monsieur.
Thank heaven. Eveline, I've wasted the best years of my youth worshipping a wicked woman who cheated me and finally made a fool of me.
She was the fool, monsieur.
Bless you for saying that, Eveline. Well, you must know what I'm trying to say. I'm told women do know. I love you, Eveline. I want you to go back to Puy-Verdun with me.
Oh, monsieur.
As my wife, will you?
You will have to speak to my father.
Forgive me, but I already have.
Oh, you are a soldier, monsieur.
But what is your answer, Eveline?
I will marry you.
Oh, Eveline, my adorable one. This is...
Yes, go on. Is anything the matter?
No. No, of course not. This is the happiest moment of my life. Puy-Verdun was not the sordid, lonely place I had left. The difference was my charming bride. Now when I rode through the village, the children actually crowded about our carriage. They no longer feared the Debussac who sat beside the lady. Her charities had won her their love and transformed the gloomy lord into a gentle master. They even forgot the untimely death of my cousin. And I no longer hesitated with that strange catch in my throat to tell her about it. Eveline, I never knew I could be so happy.
Why, too, Hector. I'm happier than I ever dreamed.
Even the villagers feel it. They used to avoid me like a plague.
You only imagine that. Why should they avoid such a gentle master?
Maybe it's because you've made me so, Eveline. I feel like a traveler who's just been transplanted from the frozen Arctic wastes to the heart of some green and friendly valley. It's almost... Oh, I don't know, darling. Sometimes I doubt it.
Why, dearest?
It seems almost fantastic to be so happy. I could be aroused so rudely at any moment with a coarse shout of reality.
You aren't dreaming, husband. I won't allow it. For you know, if you were, I would be too, and I wouldn't like that.
See what I mean? Nothing like this ever happened to me before. It's like standing in the bright sun.
Hector?
Yes?
Who's the lord of the chateau nearest to this?
What?
Who is he, Hector?
Darling, don't you realize that this is the only chateau within 40 miles?
That's strange.
Why?
Because I saw him again yesterday.
Him? Whom did you see?
I don't know now.
Suppose you tell me about it.
Well, in my walks about the park and woods in the past month, I keep meeting a man who appears to be of a noble rank.
Of noble rank? Are you sure you don't mean a peasant?
No. His dress and his bearing was that of a nobleman. I couldn't have mistaken that. I imagine that he must occupy some chateau near Puy-Verdun.
That's not possible, Eveline. We're in the heart of a desolate region. No, that couldn't be possible. Well, come here a moment.
Yes, monsieur.
See the picture there on the wall?
This one, monsieur?
No, the one next to it. That's right. I want you to...
Yes, monsieur.
I want a curtain hung over that picture as soon as possible. Understand?
Oui, monsieur.
Good. Now bring some tea to your lady's drawing room. In spite of myself, I was disturbed by Eveline's visitant. That night I asked her more about it. Eveline, this man you say you saw...
Say I saw. I did, in fact, I do see him.
How often?
Every day.
Every day, where?
Sometimes in the park and sometimes in the wood. You know that little cascade and the old rock work that makes a sort of a cavern?
Yes, I know the place. I used to play there with... I used to play there as a boy.
Oh, I love it. I spend my mornings there reading.
And that's where you saw... see him?
Yes.
Has he ever had the courage to address you?
Never. I look up from my book and he'll be standing there very quietly, watching me. Then I'll continue with my reading, and when I look up again, he's gone.
He must be some peasant out to frighten you. I'll go into the village tomorrow and see what I can find out.
No, Hector, he's not a peasant. He has the manner of a nobleman.
I suppose he's quite old.
On the contrary, he's young and quite handsome.
For the next week, I spent my mornings with Eveline. We took many casual rambles into the woods and park, but we saw no one but a few peasants or occasionally a member of our own chateau. These works were beginning to disturb the routine of my life. And since I was a man of rather deeply ingrained habits, my wife noticed the unrest.
There's no need to take these walks with me, Hector. You know you have other things to do. I'll spend my mornings on the grounds, and the stranger can't intrude on me there.
I'm beginning to think the stranger is your own fantasy, darling. You've probably met too many handsome cavaliers in your books. No doubt he's some Persian prince in modern costume.
Hector, that's what puzzled me. The stranger's costume isn't modern. Shall I tell you what it looks like?
By all means.
Well, he looks as if he's been in an old portrait that had stepped down from his frame.
It wouldn't have been a more startling blow if she'd butted me in the stomach with the end of a staff. I thought of the picture in the library with the orange and purple hunting costume André had worn that fateful night in the Palais Royal. Then something else happened to take my mind from the picture, André or anything else. For after a time, my wife, who had always been as lovely and glowing as the fresh petal of a rose, began to fail in her health. Her change seemed to have stolen up on her. Even I, who had seen her every day, hadn't noticed it until one day she put on a lovely gown she hadn't worn in several months. I was amazed how loosely it hung on her. Then I noticed her eyes. Eyes that had at one time sparkled as bright as the jewel she'd planted in her hair. They were now quite dim and sick. Darling, how long have you been ill?
I'm not ill, Hector.
That's insane. You are ill. Quite seriously so, I might add. Stupid of me not to notice it before. What's done this?
I feel faint.
And she fainted. I caught her in my arms and swept her to her bed. Then I sent a messenger for Dr. Corday. Tell him to come immediately. I don't want a single moment's delay, understand?
Yes, monsieur.
I stood there as helpless as a child and watched my lovely Eveline seem to waste away with this insidious thing. I cursed every moment of delay before Dr. Corday arrived. When he did come, I rushed him to her room before he'd even had a chance to remove his cape. Then I sat and poured myself a drink for the torturous wait. But even before he came out to speak to me, I, for no explainable reason, had lost faith in the powers of medicine to combat the thing that had struck down my Eveline.
Strange, very strange.
Doctor, is she...
Frankly, I don't know. I just don't know, my lord.
Monsieur le docteur, I mean, I was beginning to be afraid that she may be a little... Well, Dr. Corday, this isn't easy to say.
Well, then, let me say it for you. You're wondering if she's insane. Let me assure you that she is not.
Oh, thank heaven. She's been seeing some... well...
Oh, you mean this strange visitant? Oh, yes, she spoke of it. It's possible that she may be suffering from some sort of illusion at that. But she's so rational on all the other accounts. I think that this person is quite real, at least to the eye. Usually, a monomaniac tells very incoherent stories of their illusions. Hers is no such thing. She speaks as calmly and rationally as you and I. Are you positive that there is no one who can encounter her in her walks about the garden?
I don't see how. The moat is 10 feet wide and continually flooded with water. Raoul keeps the lock secured day and night. No, I don't see how it's possible.
Well, perhaps someone related to your household in some way. A young man with a fair womanish face and a crimson scar that looks as if it might have been the mark of a violent blow.
Oh, no. The dress doctor. How is he dressed?
In a hunting costume. A purple and orange hunting costume.
Doctor, this... oh, no. What can I do?
Right now, my lord, you'd better go in and see Lady de Brissac. She's asked for you.
Darling, how are you?
Oh, Hector.
Evelyn, why haven't you told me? The doctor says you've seen the stranger again.
I see him every day. That's what's killing me.
I rushed down to the library, took down the portrait, and showed it to my wife. She looked at it and trembled like a leaf. She clung to me as if she were about to fall into some nameless chasm.
It's witchcraft. The costume is the very same.
Then she described his face to me, line for line, even to the cruel mark my hand had left. I knew that Henri de Brissac had come back to keep his promise. I took Evelyn away. We traveled through the southern provinces and on into the heart of Switzerland. I wanted to outdistance the phantom. It was no good. He followed us everywhere we went. Never did I see him. Always Eveline. That type of vengeance had Andre's touch. He used my wife's innocent heart as his cruel weapon. His constant, unholy intrusion was destroying her. Nor could I shield her or drive Andre from her.
He's here even now, Hector. As you stand there and I here, he stands between us. He'll never let me rest nor let me forget him.
Thus it was I fought like a madman to get something I couldn't see, fought through this terrible void to get back to the side of my beloved wife. And then, a short time later, we were in a Tyrolean village. It was a brilliant moonlit night. I was about to speak a word of encouragement to Eveline when she spoke.
Hector, I'm going to tell you something so strange and terrible that you'll probably hate me forever.
Hate you? Why, my poor darling.
Oh, no, please, don't sympathize with me. I won't be able to tell you, and I must tell you, I must.
Darling, you're just tired. What you need is some
Hector,
rest.
Hector, I'm dying.
No. No, Evelyn, you're not.
Yes, I know it. That's why I must say what I have to say.
I won't listen.
You must listen. At first, when I began to see the stranger in the park, I shrank from him. He seemed terrible to me. Day after day, he came. Then one day, I wasn't afraid anymore. I found that I was thinking about him, watching for him. Then for a while, I didn't see him.
Was that when I was with you?
Yes. Even then, when I was with you, I found that I was desolate without him.
Eveline, you don't know what you're saying.
Oh, believe me, Hector, I do. I wouldn't blame you if you killed me. But I began to count the hours to the time when I'd see him next. He took all the old joys from my heart and left me nothing but the unholy pleasure of his presence. Now, Hector, curse me, kill me, anything. Only know this. Whatever it was, witchcraft, the imperfections of my heart, I don't know. I only know I fought against it and couldn't win. Now I'm dying, and oh, forgive me if you can.
Forgive you? What is there to forgive, my darling? This is no work of yours. Oh, Evelyn, my wife, forget everything but that you're in my arms. Forget everything except that we love each other.
I'm dying, Hector. I'm dying.
No. Fight it, Evelyn. Please try to fight it. I need you. I can't live without you.
Forgive me, Hector. I want to die. I want to be with him.
Her eyes fluttered and she was gone. Something more than the cruel lash of her words hit me. Even though I was barely conscious, I felt it. I got up and ran to the mirror. Sure enough, there it was. That vivid outline of the hand, full across my cheek.
So runs the tale of The Mark of Shame. Remember to join us next week at the same time for another journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy.
Tonight's program was adapted from Miss Braddon's story, Eveline's Visitant, by Robert Olson. Heard tonight were Richard Thorne as Hector, Beth Calder as Eveline, Archie Hugely as Andre, Ken Jensen as Dr. Corday, and Michael Arogo as Raoul. Musical background was provided by Earl Donaldson. The engineer was Nephi Sorensen. These programs are produced and directed by Richard Thorne. Remember, be with us again next Sunday night on call at 9:30 when the Granite Furniture Stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo will take you on another journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy.
The Hall of Fantasy, untuned to yesterday from the 1st of May, 1947 on CBS. The author credited with that story was Miss Braddon, whose name was actually Mary Elizabeth Braddon, and was best known as an author of sensational Victorian stories, most famously Lady Audley's Secret and Aurora Floyd. And she was one of the 19th century's most prolific authors, penning 150 short stories and over 90 novels. This is an hour of horror on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for The Haunting Hour with a broadcast called Homicide House. From NBC syndication from June 30th, 1945.
No. No, stay where you are. Do not break the stillness of this moment, for this is a time of mystery. A time when imagination is free and moves forward swiftly, silently. This is the haunting hour.
Homicide House. Our story begins late at night, in one of the rooms of an exclusive Florida hotel.
Hello. Hello?
Mr. Hubert, Van Cleek?
Yes, yes.
This is Special Investigator Collins of the Miami Police.
Indeed. Well, what the devil is the idea of waking a man in the middle of the night?
I'm sorry, Mr. Van Cleek, but we have reason to believe that your life is in danger.
My life in danger? Nonsense. Who would want to do away with me?
I don't know, sir, but this is a warning. Be sure your door is locked, and your windows, too. You've been followed by...
I know that. I've been followed by a pack of idiots who want to sell me everything from insurance to yachts. I'm used to that, and I know how to deal with these parasites. Now, good night, Mr. Collins.
But Mr. Van Cleek.
Good night, sir. A fool. Ringing me up at this time of night. Tell me that my... Who's there? Who's at the window?
Hanson, managing editor. Oh, it's you, Senator. No, sir, the New York Clarion will not retract that statement. This is an independent newspaper. What? You'll take us to court? Go ahead. We've got all the facts on that water waste project, and we can prove them by affidavit. Sorry, Senator, I haven't time to argue with you. I'm a busy man.
All right, Chief.
What's doing?
Sit down, you two. I've got an assignment I want you to handle together.
Say, Chief, if it's about that phony waterways deal, why, that's just my dish.
No, Bill, it isn't the waterways project.
Oh.
You remember the Hubertus Van Cleek murder case down in Florida a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, he was shot in some hotel room.
By a murderer. Murder is unknown.
That's right. Well, as you know, old Hubertus was the last of his line. One of the oldest and wealthiest society families in New York.
Yeah, the Van Cleeks had plenty in the sock, all right.
And there wasn't even a will.
Yes. Now, here's the angle. Every Van Cleek, from Hubertus right back to old Theodore, the original settler, has died by violence. For some reason, not one ever died a natural death. Remember Claudius Van Cleek?
Yeah, I've heard about him. He was a little before my time. A Wall Street speculator, wasn't he?
Yes. Well, he ruined thousands of people in the market. And one of them finally stuck a knife into it.
Ah.
That left two sons and one daughter. Hubertus, Hector, and Abigail.
Well, we know what happened to Hubertus. But what about Hector and Abigail?
Well, back in 1898, they took a boat called the Portland for Europe to escape the disgrace of what their father had done. But the Portland went down in a storm off Cape Cod, and so did Hector and Abigail.
Yeah, well, all that's very interesting, Chief, but it's all stuff. What's the story?
Now, wait a minute. I'm coming to that. I just got a tip that a syndicate in town is going to tear down the old Van Cleek mansion overlooking the East River and build a new skyscraper on the property.
Well, that's just as well. That old mausoleum's an eyesore. It's been boarded up for years.
I still don't see...
I want the whole Van Cleek story from soup to finger bowls for our Sunday supplement. Hit this mysterious tradition of sudden death in the Van Cleek family hard. Give me plenty of color and the flavor of the past. Go down with Maureen here and take a good look at the old Van Cleek mansion so that you can write about it intelligently. And we'll want pictures.
Well, it doesn't sound very exciting. Look, Chief, if you'd give us that water...
Your assignment, Mr. Foster, is the Van Cleek story. Now get out, and don't slam the door.
I knew I should have been a radio commentator. Come on, Maureen. Okay, driver, here you are.
The Van Cleek house, Bill.
Yeah, just a nice, big, gloomy sandstone tomb.
Wonder if those boards on the windows are just to keep the light out or the ghosts in.
I guess this is the kind of place they call a Victorian monstrosity, huh?
It's terribly big.
Yeah, I'll bet that syndicate Hanson was talking about will have to pay plenty for this property.
Well, they can have it, Bill. No wonder Hubertus Van Cleek closed and boarded it up back in the 90s. I don't see how anyone could live in there.
Hey, it's beginning to snow, honey. Come on, let's walk up this driveway.
We're not going in, are we?
No, there's no way to get in. We'll just take a couple of pictures front and back and then scram. I've got the flashbulb set in it. What was that?
Sounded like a shot.
Yeah, and it came from inside the house.
Inside? But Bill, no one's been inside that house for almost 50 years.
There's someone in there now.
Well, then it must be a ghost.
If it is, he's up to no good. Come on, Maureen. We're going to get in and have a look around.
Bill, where are we?
Well, in the cellar, obviously. But more than that, in the wine cellar. You smell the champagne?
Yes.
It's funny how the odor of wine would still be here after 50 years.
Mm. Bill, is it safe to use your flashlight in here?
Well, in view of that shot we heard, no. We've got to see where we're going. Yeah. Nice place for murder, huh?
Mm. Look at all those spider webs. Why, the place is practically covered with them.
Hey, never mind the spider webs. Look at those bottles on the shelves. Champagne imported. 1876, 1879, 18... Why, the place is loaded with vintages.
Yes. But why should we be able to smell the wine?
I don't know. We'd better try to find a way upstairs. That's shut.
Bill.
Yeah. Footsteps.
Someone's upstairs.
No doubt about it.
Bill, maybe we better get out and call the police.
What? And ruin a good story? Here, Maureen. You carry my camera. I want my hands free, just in case.
All right. Where are we going now?
There's only one place to go. Upstairs. Ah, this must be the door leading to the first floor. Uh-huh. It's open, too. Come on.
That door makes enough noise to wake the dead.
I'm not worried about the dead. It's that live ghost somewhere in this big Victorian barn that I'm worried about.
What kind of a place is this? It's tremendous.
Looks like the Grand Ballroom.
Shades of the gay 90s. So this is where the 400 played in the mauve decade.
Yeah, gaslight fixtures and all.
Oh, those awful statues and statuettes. They're horrible.
Yeah, they ought to open this place up as a museum.
Hey, here's a neat little piece. I can carry it in one hand, too.
Why?
We're chasing a ghost here, remember? And he's got a gun. We haven't. This little stone figure might come in handy. See what I mean?
He's up there now, on the second floor.
Yeah, and sooner or later, we'll catch up to him. Now, this seems to be the main second floor corridor.
Mm-hmm. Bill?
Hmm?
Do you notice something?
What?
Seems clean here. So someone lived here on the second floor.
Yeah, you're right. It's warmer, too. There's no musty smell.
And no spider webs.
Wonder what that means.
Bill.
Well, seems that our friend the ghost not only likes to shoot off guns, but he likes to tickle the ivories, too.
Huh? Maybe he heard us.
Come on, Maureen. This is it. You stay behind me. I'll go first, just in case.
All right, Bill. But be careful.
Yeah, come on.
This is the room. I think I can even make out the piano.
Yeah, but there doesn't seem to be anyone here.
Huh? Bill!
I shouldn't move if I were you. You see, it might be quite unhealthy.
Bill, there's a man lighting a candle.
Yeah.
Look, why, he's got mutton chop whiskers and he's dressed in old-fashioned formal clothes.
Who are you? My name is Hodgkins. I'm the Van Cleek butler.
The Van Cleek butler? Well, that can't be. All the Van Cleeks are dead.
I must differ with you, madam. I was just entertaining the Van Cleeks with a piano selection when you interrupted.
Maureen, he's nuts.
Who are you, and why are you prowling about the premises?
Oh, we're from the New York Clarion.
Yes, it's the truth. See, the name of our paper's printed on the side of this camera.
Well, we heard a shot, and
I'm sorry, sir, but you heard no shot.
Now, there, wasn't that a shot?
Only a door slamming shut. This is a large establishment with considerable air currents and drafts. That is no doubt what you heard when you forced entry.
Oh, yes, Bill. It must have been a door slamming.
And now I must ask you to leave the premises at once.
Hodgkins, who is it?
We have callers, eh? Undesirable callers, Mr. Van Cleek.
Bill, look how they're dressed. The styles of 50 years ago.
We haven't had callers in the longest time. Oh, nice.
No, Abigail.
Oh, come, come, Hector. Ask our guests to sit down. Hodgkins, set the table for four.
Four, but madam...
Four place settings, Hodgkins, please.
Yes, madam.
Are you... Do I understand that you're Abigail Van Cleek?
Oh, yes. And this is my brother, Hector.
But you're supposed to be dead. You drowned back in 1898 when a ship went down.
There must be some mistake. As you see, we're very much alive. We haven't had the pleasure, however...
Oh, I'm Bill... Mr. William Foster.
Oh.
This is Miss Maureen Davis. We're
How
both
do
from
do?
The New York Daily Clarion.
The Clarion?
Uh-huh.
Oh, I've never heard of it. Of course, we read only the Tribune. Is it a new paper?
New? I wouldn't exactly say so, Miss Van Cleek. It was started back in 1903.
Well, strange. Very strange. This is 1898, isn't it, Hector?
Why, of course, my dear. I'm afraid these lovely people are a little confused. Everyone knows it's 1898.
Oh, sure, of course. Well, we better be going.
Going? Oh, no. I've already given Hodgkins his instructions. You're staying for dinner.
Oh, why, we...
Why, I'm afraid we couldn't.
Oh, please, we're so lonely. We haven't had any guests in the longest time.
Well, I...
We'd be delighted to have you. Say you'll stay...
Of course. Thank you very much. We'll be glad to.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Oh, good. Oh, you people are so kind. I must talk to Hodgkins about the dinner at once.
No, I'll go with you, my dear. You'll pardon me, won't you?
Oh, sure, of course.
Bill, I just can't believe it.
Neither can I.
What do you mean?
I'm still not sure that loud report we heard was a door slamming. It still sounded like a shot to me.
Bill Foster and Maureen Davis, New York reporters, have entered the old Van Cleek mansion, closed and boarded up for 50 years. As far as they know, all the Van Cleeks are dead. The last of the line, Hubertus, having been killed in Florida. But now they meet two apparitions apparently out of the past and living in the old Victorian house. These are Hector and Abigail Van Cleek, who believe they are living in the year 1898. And look it. Hector wears mutton chop whiskers, high-buttoned shoes, and Chesterfield coat. Abigail is dressed in crinoline and old lace. Both might have stepped out of tintypes cast in the gaslight era. Abigail Van Cleek has gone with Hector to make arrangements for dinner. Now Hector returns to Bill and Maureen.
You're probably wondering about my sister and me, Mr. Foster.
Wondering isn't the word for it.
We were sure all the Van Cleeks were dead.
As far as the world has known, they are. But now I'm afraid we can't keep our secret any longer. You see, we were on the Portland when it went down back in 98. But we didn't drown as everyone thought. Abigail and I were on a raft, and we made the shore.
Well, then why?
You wonder why we didn't reveal our identity? Well, our father, Claudius, disgraced us in the stock market, Miss Davis. We were, well, ashamed. We wanted to hide from the world. And so I conceived the idea of coming back here to the old house after Hubertus had closed it, and living our lives out away from the accusing eyes of the world.
I see. And you've lived here for 50 years, hmm?
Yes, Abigail, I, and Hodgkins. Hodgkins, our family's faithful retainer, had volunteered to stay with us till the end. It's he who buys the food and other necessities, going out only at night. It was he who brought us the news of our brother Hubertus' untimely death.
You mean you and your sister haven't even left this house for 50 years?
That's correct, Miss Davis. And we hope that here we shall die a peaceful and natural death. Contrary to the tradition of our family.
Oh,
there's something further I must explain.
Yes, Mr. Van Cleek.
My sister, Abigail, she, well, when the ship went down, she lost her mind.
What?
That is, it stopped in terms of time. She actually thinks she's still living in the 90s.
I see.
But you know all about the present.
Yes, of course. But you see, I've always been very devoted to Abigail. And that's why I've lived with her all these years, humored her. That's why I wear these ancient clothes. Fashionable in the 90s, but strange to the present eyes.
Strange isn't the word for it. We thought we'd seen a couple of ghosts.
Of course. I understand. I ask only one thing.
Yes, Mr. Van Cleek.
Please humor my sister along. Live with her in the past. Even though you know it's ridiculous, I'd appreciate it deeply.
Of course, Mr. Van Cleek.
Yes, you can depend on us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, there you are. I'm so sorry I was delayed. The curry, you know, is such an exacting entree. And, of course, the champagne. Hodgkins and I always differ on the champagne. Have you been to the opera lately, Miss Davis?
Why, no.
Oh, what a pity. There's a young tenor named Arrigo Caruso. Just a young man, a mere boy. But he sings so divinely. I haven't been so thrilled since I heard Jenny Lind sing. Of course, that must be, 15 years ago.
Well, I do go to the theater occasionally.
Oh, theater. Theater, I do love it. Oh, those lovely young creatures. Lily Langtry and Lillian Russell. And Edwin Booth. Oh, poor fellow. Died 5 years ago. Oh, what a tragedy. What an actor.
Dinner is served.
Oh, thank you, Hodgkins.
More wine, Miss Davis?
Oh, no, thank you, Mr. Van Cleek.
Mr. Foster?
Oh, thanks, I couldn't touch another drop.
You may remove the wine, Hodgkins.
Yes, madam.
It's been a wonderful dinner, Miss Van Cleek. I haven't had food like that since the war.
Oh, yes, the war. Isn't it terrible? Still, we're fortunate in having men like Roosevelt and Dewey to lead us against the Spaniards.
Roosevelt? And Dewey?
Against the Spaniards?
Yes. Abigail's right. Admiral Dewey's victory in Manila Bay. And, of course, Teddy Roosevelt's gallant charge at San Juan Hill.
Will
there be anything else, madam?
No, Hodgkins, I don't think so. Oh, yes. You might tell me what the weather is like outside.
It's snowing very hard, madam.
Oh, then I'm afraid it will be very difficult for Miss Davis and Mr. Foster to get a hansom cab now.
Yes, madam, it will.
Well, I'd suggest that they stay overnight here as our guests, Hector. Don't you think that's a splendid idea?
I certainly do, Abigail.
Miss Van Cleek, we couldn't.
Oh, we don't want to put you out.
Oh, no, we'd be delighted to have you.
Yes, we insist.
Well, I'm sorry, but we...
Please, it would make Miss Van Cleek and myself very happy.
Well...
Thank you, Mr. and Miss Van Cleek. We'll stay.
Oh, that's wonderful. Hodgkins!
Yes, madam.
Prepare two rooms for our guests.
Yes, madam. At once.
It's incredible, Bill. Those two charming people living the life of 50 years ago in this dismal house.
Yeah.
When we get back to the chief with this story, you'll never believe it.
I'm not sure that I do.
What do you mean?
It all may not be as Victorian as it looks.
Bill, I don't understand. You mean there's something fishy about all this?
Well, it could be.
But we've been with them all the time. We've seen everything with our own eyes.
Yeah, and a little extra.
Bill Foster, what are you driving at?
Did you notice the butler's wrist when he served us our soup?
Hodgkins, no. What about it?
Well, his wrist was tanned. I could tell because the white skin showed where he had worn a wristwatch.
Well, what are you talking about? Suppose he did have a coat of tan.
Look, from what we heard, this big butler, Hodgkins, hasn't been anywhere but in this gloomy mausoleum or else out at night to do the shopping. Is that right?
That's right.
Yet he has a coat of tan in the middle of winter and with no exposure to the sun.
Yeah, that does seem funny.
Well, don't you get it? Where's the only place Hodgkins might get a tan in the middle of winter?
Well, in the South.
Florida, maybe?
Bill, Florida. Why, that's
yes,
where...
Yes, that's where Hubertus Van Cleek was murdered.
Then you think Hodgkins might have had something to do with it?
I don't know. Personally, I don't like him. There's something about his eyes. You know what we ought to do?
What?
Get out of here in a hurry. This thing is beginning to come together like a jigsaw puzzle, and it isn't nice. Here, I'll carry the camera.
Bill,
there's
what...
There's no time to talk now. We've got to leave fast if we're going to leave at all. Come on, Maureen. Let's try the back way. The last time I saw our pal Hodgkins, he was prowling around in the front of the house.
This seems to be the servants' quarters.
Yeah. I'll try this door. Maybe it'll lead down into the cellar, and then we can make our getaway the same way we came in. It's no good. It's locked tight.
Here's another door. I'll try it. Bill! Oh, Bill!
Yeah, the bunny. We're standing up in that closet, and when you opened the door, it fell out.
Oh, Bill.
Keep your chin up, baby. Don't lose your grip. I'm going to take a look. Uh-huh. Bullet hole right through the heart.
Then that must have been the shot we heard.
There's no doubt about it. That door slam alibi was a phone... Wait a minute. The devil's got identification papers. Well, I'll be...
What is it, Bill?
This guy's name was Collins. He was a special police investigator for the Miami police.
Then he must have followed Hodgkins up here on the Hubertus Van Cleek murder.
Precisely, Miss Davis. Huh? And, of course, I had to do away with him.
Hodgkins?
Yes. Now, don't move, Mr. Foster. This gun works very well, I assure you.
So it was you who murdered Hubertus Van Cleek.
You're a very clever young man, Mr. Foster.
Did you nail him, Hodgkins?
Got him cold, Nixon.
I guess it's all settled about what we'll do with him.
It's all settled, Margie.
Nixon. Margie.
Yeah, in other words, Hector and Abigail. Pretty clever impersonations, too.
Thank you, Mr. Foster.
Looks like we'll have to give these two nosy newspaper characters the same business we gave that cop, Collins.
Yeah, Nixon, looks like.
Bill.
I'm afraid they've got us, Maureen. I've got to hand it to you, crooks. The neatest inheritance racket I've ever heard about.
Inheritance racket?
Yeah, this little trio knocked off Hubertus, last of the Van Cleeks. That means that there weren't any existing relatives to claim the Van Cleek fortune until very recently.
That is until Nixon and Margie here brought Hector and Abigail out of a watery grave.
That's right.
Pretty clever, aren't you, Mr. Foster?
Yeah, too smart for his own good, eh, Hodgkins?
That's right, Nixon.
But, Bill, how could they prove that they were Hector and Abigail Van Cleek?
Well, they fooled us, didn't they, baby? It was a beautiful act and a very nice little story. Besides, there was always Hodgkins here to add the final clincher.
So you know that too, Mr. Foster?
Yeah, I took the trouble to read a few old clippings down at the Clarion Morgue. You really were the Van Cleek butler. As the faithful family retainer, you could positively identify these two phonies here as Hector and Abigail Van Cleek. Then ring yourself in on a nice three-way split on the dough.
No use wasting any more time, Hodgkins. Let him have it.
Yeah, we'll have our work cut out to bury them in the cellar.
Bill.
Steady, baby. I've shot plenty of people with this camera of mine, but this is the first time I've ever been on the receiving end of a...
Put that camera down. Quick, let him have it.
The flashbulb, right?
Hodgkins,
your gun on the floor.
Maureen, it's gone.
I've got the gun, Bill.
Okay, let me have it. Well, isn't this fun?
Oh, Hodgkins, you fool.
You really couldn't help it, Abigail. Or rather, Margie. That flashbulb in my camera just went off and blinded him.
Bill, you're wonderful.
Thanks, baby. Now, if you'll hurry out to the police, I'll keep these characters entertained. Don't forget to phone the chief in exclusive on this first.
I won't. Are you sure you'll be all right, Bill?
Oh, I'll be all right. But if any of these lovely people try anything, they'll die a real Van Cleek death by violence. Premeditated.
From shadows and stillness, mystery weaves a spell of strangest fascination, charging the mind with doubts and fears. For mystery is a strange companion, a living memory. In the haunting hour.
Haunting Hour, on Tuned to Yesterday from June 30th, 1945, an NBC syndicated broadcast, wrapping up this hour of horror on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.